Very good evening to you. Welcome to this LSE event, which is really to celebrate the launch, the publication of a book called One Party After Another, The Disruptive Life of Nigel Farage. It's hosted at the LSE jointly by the LSE's European Institute, School of Public Policy and the Library. My name's Tony Travers and I'm professor in the School of Public Policy in the Government Department, and I'm delighted to be chairing this evening's event. For those Twitter users in the audience, feel free to use the hashtag for today's event, which is rather retro way, hashtag LSE Brexit. But you can see an event involving Nigel Farage probably does merit that. The event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. And I should say that the reason we're starting a bit late is we did have the odd technical difficulty, and I'm sorry for that. So the way the event will work is that I'm going to introduce our guest and the author of the book, and then we will have a brief Q&A. And then I would like to encourage you as soon as possible, and I think Nigel Farage is not, indeed Michael Crick, are not the kind of characters who are not going to provoke some interesting questions. So I would encourage you to start putting the questions in the Q&A as soon as you feel you want to, and as soon as possible, really. Now I'm going to introduce our speaker, but not at elaborate length, because he will be very well known to many of you. Michael Crick has been a journalist for 40 years, with an array of posts in Channel 4, the BBC, and was the political editor of Newsnight. He's included books about the militant, the famous Trotskyite militant tendency, and biographies of Arthur Scargill, Geoffrey Archer, Michael Heseltine, Alex Ferguson, and David Butler. And if that doesn't tell you about his interests, both political and otherwise, what else could? He was a Royal Television Society Specialist Journalist of the Year more than once, and has received the Charles Wheeler Award for outstanding contribution to British to broadcast journalism. And his latest publication, which we're here to talk about today, One Party After Another, offers an account of the life of one of Britain's most controversial, though influential, political figures, Nigel Farage. I'm not going to introduce Nigel Farage because that would be slightly over the top, really. And if you're watching and you don't know who Nigel Farage is, then it's going to be an interesting evening. So welcome, everybody. I want to begin by saying, again, thank you for taking part in this event, Michael. And can I just start off with a slightly trivial question for a serious book about a serious person? You've called the book One Party After Another. Was this a title chosen before or after Partygate kicked off?
Well, long before Partygate.
Right, I thought it might be.
I felt very pleased with myself when I came up with that title, because I thought it works three ways. You know, here's Nigel Farage, a guy who enjoys life, a guy who enjoys having a drink, having a party. And then, of course, it also refers to the fact that he has led, astonishingly, he has won elections in this country with two different parties, UKIP and the Brexit Party. UKIP won the Euro elections in 2014. The Brexit Party won them in 2019. And of course, he's also, before that, he used to belong to the Conservative Party and voted Green once. So it's one party after another in that sense. Yeah. And also, of course, it's one party after another in the sense that for a lot of the teen years, the UKIP hit the parties led by Nigel Farage were going after the Conservative Party and the Labour Party to a degree. But I admit it's more, you know, now it's perhaps works a bit better with Boris Johnson. But all I'd say, my title works three ways with this man and only two ways with Boris Johnson. Now, very the key good. Thing, I mean, I'm really delighted you should have invited me tonight, because especially because more than any other academic institution, the London School of Economics has played a big role in Nigel Farage's career and, more importantly, the career of UKIP. UKIP was essentially founded at the LSE in various meetings way back in the early 90s by a European historian, Alan Sked, now retired. And his papers are actually in the library at the LSE. And it's one of my great regrets in doing this book that I wasn't actually able to get access to the papers because I was doing all the research during the COVID period. More than any other university, it's appropriate the LSE should invite me, because Farage himself has never really been a great university figure. Never went to university. I can't see him ever being getting an honorary degree from anywhere, or indeed taking a proper degree himself.
That's not this side of the Atlantic, though he has been to speak here. He's spoken at a major public event here. We like to have a very wide spread of public speakers. And, though I'm not sure the whole of the audience at the LSE agreed with him, the rapport and the way he worked with the audience at the time was itself fascinating to watch. Just bringing us on to Farage as an individual, and you've already hinted at this, he's been incredibly successful, arguably, at influencing British politics, but entirely unsuccessful personally winning a parliamentary seat, at least in the United Kingdom. Why do you think he was so good at one, but managed to get the tactics for winning a seat so wrong in Britain?
Well, in terms of his influence on our history, that is a big issue. But I mean, essentially, I think he was influential in three ways. One is, ironically, Farage did not believe in the referendum as the way to achieve Brexit. He believed that UKIP could get MEPs elected to the Westminster Parliament, and that they would then join up with Eurosceptics, predominantly in the Conservative Party, but also in the Labour Party, and that eventually the idea of referendum or even Brexit itself would be forced through the House of Commons. An idea that, looking back retrospectively, looks absolutely crazy, and that would never have happened. But actually, when other people were campaigning for a referendum, notably Nikki Sinclair in 2011 managed to do a petition and a debate in the Commons, Farage wasn't interested until the very last moment. He was sort of shamed into signing her petition. Second, and so Farage, in his leadership of UKIP, during the coalition years, pressurized and terrorized, really panicked, I think, David Cameron and the Conservatives into conceding the yes-no referendum, and then, of course, they were forced to have it once they sort of unexpectedly really won the 2015 election. So that's the first area of influence. Second, of course, through his leadership of the Brexit Party in 2019, and the extraordinary result they got in the Euro elections, although the Brexit Party very, very nearly did not happen. It's one of those great accidents of history. It came within days of not happening. They trounced Theresa May and the Conservatives, reduced them to fifth place in those elections, and forced Theresa May's departure, and I think played a huge role also in the election of Boris Johnson. Not directly, obviously, but yeah. The Conservative Party were looking around, and they were panicked. They always overreact to UKIP results in Euro elections, and ended up, voting for Boris Johnson as their answer to Nigel Farage. And of course, the two men have a lot in common. Although I think they probably would have elected Johnson anyway if Farage hadn't been there. But I think he did contribute to that. And third, I would argue that the whole of UKIP's campaigns in various elections, and indeed the referendum campaign, were the initial roadmap for what we now call as the Red Wall. Those places which the Conservatives picked up in 2019 were the seats that UKIP had identified, some of them back in 2015 and 2017, and which the referendum campaigns had identified as promising territory for a yes vote in the referendum. And, in a way, Farage was a sort of John the Baptist to Boris Johnson's successful 2019 strategy. But as for why he was never elected to Parliament, and he tried seven times, the problem he has is that more people dislike Farage than like him. He's very much a Marmite character, I'm sorry to use that cliche. And I think there was also an element in some of the elections, parliamentary elections that he might have won, Buckingham in 2010 and South Thanet in 2015, of the parties ganging up together against him. Certainly you saw that in South Thanet, where Labour, who had held the South Thanet seat up until 2010, saw that they were heading for third place and basically ran a they didn't pull all the stops out in the way and have the national contribution in the way that they would have normally had in a marginal, and basically said, look, we will leave it to the Conservatives to take on Farage. And of course, that's what happened. So, and I think Farage realised in the end, he was never going to win a parliamentary election, or at least he would only do so in the most extraordinary circumstances as a person, as an individual. It would have had to have been exactly the right seat at exactly the right moment for him to get into parliament. So you have this situation where he is, I think, being the most influential British politician of this century. We've only been going 22 years so far, admittedly, without ever having won a Westminster seat, and he never will win a Westminster seat. The best he can do is to go into the House of Lords. The only caveat I'd say there is that, you know, that there must be a slight possibility of Farage joining the Conservative Party. He always sort of regards himself as a Conservative. He had this sort of love-hate relationship with the Conservatives. At one point, he tried to, while he was a UKIP MEP, he tried to become a Conservative MP. And, you know, there was a poll a couple of years ago which showed that 54% of Conservative Party members would have been happy to see Nigel Farage as their leader. I think it's pretty unlikely, but, I mention it here just in case it happens, and I can say I did point it out to the LSE many years ago.
Well, never say never in British politics. I want to come back to the sort of Brexit red wall issue in a moment, but just to sort of while we're on the man and his approach, do you see him as in writing the book as a sort of analytical and intellectually coherent political thinker, just an instinctive, feels how to do it type politician, which I suspect Boris Johnson is in some ways too.
I think Farage is, am I allowed to use the phrase? Yeah, I remember that it was always said of Michael Heseltine that he had this ability to find the clitoris of the Conservative Party. And I think that Farage is one of those people, they're rare people actually, who have an understanding for public opinion and the way the general public think and what the public are going to be able, what they're going to put up with and what they won't put up with. And he, unlike Boris Johnson, Farage loves interacting with ordinary voters on the street. Boris Johnson always finds it a bit embarrassing. He doesn't mind the selfies and all of that, but he doesn't really like talking to people on the street. Farage loves all that. He could do it all day long. And he is very, and you see it also when he did his radio programs and television programs. He does have an understanding of public opinion in the same way that, the only other people I would say who have that are Tony Blair, actually, and Rupert Murdoch. Yeah, he does have an instinctive feel for politics, but also he is an analytical person. This may not come across when you listen to him, but when you chat to him about politics, he is very extremely well informed, and he has thought through the implications of what's going on and what's likely to happen next, and so on. He didn't go to university, he didn't get very good A levels and all of that. But actually, he is a very, very bright man. And that is part of his success as well. Above all, Farage is a brilliant communicator. And he's a communicator on all the levels that you can think of that are useful in politics. The parliamentary chamber, we're talking about Strasbourg here, obviously, and Brussels occasionally. But he was very brilliant at being able to put together a 90-second speech, because that's often all you get, and then saying the right kind of things that would then get it on YouTube. In radio and television, he's brilliant at. On the street, he's brilliant at. And the conference platform, he's brilliant at, which I think are the five categories needed to be a successful political communicator these days.
And I'm guessing, correct me if I'm wrong about this, unlike Tony Blair, who we know had an enormous amount of opinion poll and focus group evidence helping him guide his way through politics, though he was a brilliant communicator analytically astute, I completely agree. But I doubt Nigel Farage uses any of that, does he? And this is just him thinking, just being him?
He did actually. There was a period, period, you remember, where they won, they got the two MPs, Carswell and Reckless. They won the two by-elections in Clacton and Rochester. And then they were trying to work out where to put their resources, because what UKIP were hoping for in 2014-15 is the balance of power. They were hoping if they could beat that, follow that up with say 12, 20 seats, then they might hold the balance of power, and that would then bring about a referendum, or not just bring about a referendum, but all sorts of other things as well. And the so what they had to do is work out what the seats should be. Now, they got some guidance, of course, from the local election results, and they'd only just started fighting local elections properly, as you well know, Tony, as it's your specialism. But they did do quite a lot of opinion polling, actually, in that period.
And interesting.
They got, and they put a lot of money into it. And that gave them some guidance as to where what constituencies to concentrate on. Although, of course, it all went wrong in the end, and they only managed to hold on to one of the by-election seats and didn't pick up any new ones.
Okay, excellent. And now we've got some questions which I'm going to come to in a minute, but just a couple more from me. I mean, you've already hinted at two of these, but I do want to go into them in a little bit more detail. I mean, what would you say are his core political beliefs, philosophical beliefs and drivers? What, if you were to ask him what drove him to go into politics and to stay in politics and the media, what version of Britain, and it's going to be beyond the way his enemies and opponents would stereotype or parody him, if you were trying to give a fair description, journalists are good at this, how would you describe his core philosophy?
Well, a patriot, a libertarian, in theory, a libertarian, and we'll qualify that in a moment. And
he believes in free trade, doesn't he?
A free trader, yeah. And I mean, you know, not far really from the philosophy of Margaret Thatcher. The only trouble is that when it came to the practice of Farage being leading his parties, he was far from being a libertarian, and he would crack down on dissent. Before it had even happened, and he would purge UKIP and the Brexit Party, more UKIP. Under the Brexit Party, he was forced to be a little bit more conciliatory and so on, because he had all these big names as his MEPs. But I think it's a nationalism, really. But I don't go farther than that. I mean, a lot of people would say Farage is a racist. Particularly people on the left and his critics. I don't go for that. I think that he was an appalling racist when he was at school. You could argue how much that matters. He was an appalling anti-Semite. Alan Scared, who I mentioned earlier, who was the founder of UKIP, LSE professor, often says that he remembers Farage coming out with an appalling phrase about, we don't need to worry about the black vote, and then a phrase beginning with N, but not the normal phrase beginning with N. They won't ever vote for us. But I found no evidence that Farage has ever used that during his adult life on other occasions, even talking to lots and lots of critics. That's one thing they don't criticize him for.
Okay.
But I think he's also guilty of pandering to racists in some of the things he's said over the years, and the famous breaking
and the famous poster
which he had a lot of doubts about.
Okay. Sorry? The poster, well, the famous poster about the migrants. I mean, that didn't help.
Yeah, the breaking point poster coincidentally on the day of Joe Cox's assassination, which added to that sort of whole atmosphere in the final days of the referendum.
I mean, moving on to something you've already touched upon, and this will be the last one from me because I've got, as I say, questions I want to pick up from the audience here. He's clearly, in David Runciman's review, friendly review of your book, he made the point that his career certainly isn't over. At least I think that was Runciman's view, but you may have your own take on that. But he now has the opportunity, and you've certainly hinted at this, to influence the future direction of the political parties, perhaps the Conservative Party, and particularly to deal with this challenge the Conservatives have, that they are the party of what you might call the traditional Conservative Party of the wider southeast outside London, and now the party of the Midlands and the North, or parts of the Midlands and the North, former Labour voters who want something very different. And do you think he's got a role either from within the Conservative Party, or frankly, given what he's done so far, from outside the Conservative Party, to not just to keep a pure Brexit, whatever that is, pure, but beyond that, to sort of help the Conservatives shape themselves to sustain this new voter base?
Not really. As I said earlier, I think, I mean, he is incredibly popular, Farage, with many conservative grassroots. And let's face it, a lot of conservative activists and members, and probably MPs, well, certainly MPs and councillors, voted for Farage's parties, certainly in 2019. I mean, I think if we could know how MPs and indeed government ministers voted in 2019, we'd be utterly shocked, I think, at the number who voted for the Brexit Party. So there's a lot of admiration in the Conservative Party, but it's difficult to see how he shapes that debate. Because, of course, there are also a lot of people at the top of the Conservative Party who can't stand Farage and who excluded him and were not willing to listen to him or consult him when, for instance, he went to see Donald Trump, what, 6 days after Donald Trump's election in 2016. And Farage feels a terrible resentment that the establishment have, you know, snubbed him and not brought him in and not recognised his abilities and his and everything. And I don't think, I don't really see that changing. I think, and I don't see any, electoral route, electoral future for Farage. I mean, it's possible that somebody eventually one day will put him in the House of Lords, I suppose. But I think his influence is more going to be through his broadcasting, which, you know, he has this nightly programme with GB News, but it's only watched by a few hundred thousand at the moment, but that may improve, and regular interventions into political debate. The trouble is that Farage craves the limelight so much, and he finds it quite frustrating, I think, that he's no longer an MEP and no longer on mainstream television as much as he was, that he pushes some issues to the extreme. He says controversial things for the sake of being controversial, when he may not even, for instance, I mean, only the other day, he said he has had what a dreadful mistake it had been for the EU and NATO to expand eastwards to the borders of the Soviet Union or the old Soviet Union, and referred to to prodding the bear with the stick. Implying really that Ukraine was the West's fault, not Russia's fault, which is, I think that then there have been several instances of that in the last year or two since he stepped down from the political mainstream, where he has pushed things he said. I just think it's the disruptor, it's the troublesome schoolboy that everybody used to see at Dulwich College, where he would say something controversial just to make a name for himself. And I think Farage's days are at the top are over, really. I mean, we're talking about a period only about 10 years, but by golly, what a 10 years they were. They did, I think, change British history. And given that the referendum result was only 52-48, I think if Farage hadn't been there, I think it probably would have gone the other way. And I think for a variety of reasons I've already said, I think, he probably more than any other player on the Brexit side, and there were goodness knows how many, was the crucial one.
Okay, great. It's very clear. And actually, on the disruption front, my colleague Nick Rowley, who in the best traditions of the modern hybrid world is sitting in the next room to me, is sort of moving the concept of the disruptor forward into another sphere of public policy, which is that if Nigel Farage is the great disruptor in British politics, and I think we can all agree on that one, what chance do you give him of disrupting current climate change policy through arguing successfully or not for a referendum on net zero?
Well, that's another example of some of the things he's been saying recently. I just don't see, I mean, it's ironic really, given that Farage never really believed in the European referendum, as I explained earlier, and I explained in much more detail in the book. And Richard North, who was one of Farage's close speechwriters and researchers at one point, has argued in his works that I don't see us having a referendum on net zero. I just don't see how that will come about, how there would be a majority in the House of Commons for it to actually have the referendum. But 20 years ago, 30 years ago, nobody would have thought we'd have a referendum on an in-out referendum on Europe. There was a lot of talk about European referendums, but they were on other aspects of Europe, like the Euro or Lisbon Treaty or whatever. So things can change, but I really don't see that at the moment. I don't see him leading that campaign. And of course, the real thing that Farage has lost with Brexit is all the advantages that flow from having a group of MEPs in the European Parliament, which gives them a bit of a platform, a bit of status, and crucially, gives them all about £500,000 a year to play with. And they're meant to spend it all on European stuff, of course. But they didn't. And of course, the other parties were guilty of this as well. And all that money was then channeled into UKIP's campaigns and the Brexit party's campaigns while they briefly had MEPs. And all of that's now gone. And of course, that only came about because the PR for the European elections introduced by the Blair government under pressure from Paddy Ashdown way back in 1999. And without PR for the European Parliament, we would never have heard of UKIP. We would have never have heard of Nigel Farage. And I don't think we would have had Brexit.
Okay. Right. Now, thank you for that. Michael Reeve, former UCL student from London. Welcome, Michael. I'm going to read this question out in full because it includes praise for you. Michael Crick's biography of Geoffrey Archer is one of the most entertaining books I've ever read. I particularly love Archer's quote on the back of it, which isn't here. Anyway, you may know it. I'm interested to know how Michael selects his subjects for biographical treatment. Now, I hinted at least one of those. I think Alex Ferguson slightly answers that. Does there have to be a degree of admiration? That's a very interesting question. Or is it a desire to want to understand the subject's motivation better? Who else is on your hit list?
Well, I haven't got anybody on the list right now. I always find when I've written a book, afterwards I say, never again. And then after about 6 months to a year, it's sort of, you know, I forget how much effort it involved and the idea comes back to me. But I suppose I'm interested in people who are highly controversial, people who haven't written. I mean, one of the things I like to do is write books about people that nobody else has written a book about yet. And there was a massive gap in the market, obviously, with Farage, because he'd written two of his own memoirs, which aren't entirely accurate. And I spent quite a lot of time in this book correcting the record in certain places. But amazingly, nobody ever done a book on him, and given his role in, I mean, there are books about much more obscure politicians than Farage have been come out. And I think one of the reasons was, you know, I was talking to a leading figure in publishing, is that publishers were reluctant to touch it because they, maybe, but this person was suggesting it's because people in the publishing world don't like Farage. I don't know how that explains why publishers publish books on people like Hitler and Stalin, but so that may be the reason why it never happened. So that was good news from my point of view. I first wanted to do it, you know, getting on for 8-10 years ago when he first emerged, but I didn't have the time. As for my other subjects, well, I suppose I choose people who are, quite a few of my subjects are what I call charming monsters. In other words, when they have charm, they really have charm. You know, they have this ability to really be nice and turn it on and everything in a way that ordinary human beings most of us can't do. And, you know, Geoffrey Archer is a very good example of that. Alex Ferguson's a very good example of that. And there are a lot of other people in public life who could put, and Michael Howard was a good example of that. A lot of people in public life who could put into that category. And the monster bit is that when they're bastards, they really are absolute bastards, and they purge their opponents and get rid of people and act in a sort of Stalinist with a small s, I suppose, way. And in fact, that certainly applies to Farage. And, you know, I love these complex characters. And I also love characters who've achieved some success in more than once, or people who've been successful in various different careers, you know, like Heseltine. Was fascinating. I wrote about him because he had been incredibly successful in publishing, but also very, very successful in politics. And so therefore you've almost, it's like you're able to look at it from in perspective. You get a better idea of what makes them successful.
Ferguson, I'm guessing you might be a local thing in football. Is that? I mean, but yes, just a guess. Well, local to Manchester.
I'm a big United follower, as some of your viewers may know, and it was quite a, you know, I was very nervous about that book and how it would be received by my fellow fans, because I was quite critical of Ferguson, but it was okay in the end.
Okay, very good. Right, question from Germany. Udo Schmeiser, contacting us from Germany. I'm trying to figure all the information out. You said Farage could not win a political seat as people do not like him enough, the sort of Marmite point, hope that travels to Germany. At the same time, he's a great communicator. So concerning Brexit, did he pick up the mood in the population for Leave, or did he shape it somehow? I watched the BBC and was quite often in England and reading newspapers, but his statements to me always seemed to be taken for granted and never really questioned. Now, I think actually the never really questioned point is a really strong one, because others have observed how often the BBC put him on Question Time and other programmes compared with everybody else in politics. And so is it just that he's such a good communicator, the media can't resist him? But you've already addressed
there's an element of that. I mean, you're right about Question Time. I mean, if you go online, you can see all the people who've appeared on Question Time. And there was a period of it from about the year 2000 to now. Farage has been on Question Time more than any other British politician. But there's a very good reason for that, covering most of the period, because there were not, particularly the period up to about 2010, there were not that many people in politics arguing for leaving the European Union. There were Eurosceptics, you know, the David Davises of this world and Michael Howard and so on, but there were not that actually arguing for leaving the European Union. And one of the reasons why the media picked him up, well, lots of reasons. One is he's very, very good at it. I mean, I remember as a, you know, television reporter doing interviews with Farage, and you do 5 minutes, five questions, five answers, and every answer was, you know, was from a television point of view a brilliant answer, and you had an absolute struggle as to how, you know, how you were going to, which one you were going to leave out. And he would go to enormous lengths to do interviews. You know, even for local television, he would drive miles just to be, you know, in a studio for 3 minutes. So he played the media. He knew how to play the media. He worked it out. And we wanted him in the media because there was a period. I mean, it's hard to remember this, but it's not that long ago when our leading politicians were all very similar. I mean, you know, when we had Blair and Cameron and Clegg, there wasn't a huge amount of difference between the politics of those three. And Farage was a refreshing contrast. And whenever I went to, say, do a by-election, and I frequently used to cover by-elections, still do, you like to have the UKIP person in because they were a bit different from what all the other people were saying. And that partly was the success. But I mean, it's not as if we're sort of, we're often accused in the media of being, you know, of having created Farage. Hang on a moment, Farage undoubtedly represented a significant and growing band of opinion within British politics, a Eurosceptic band of opinion within British politics, which he successfully nurtured and grew. And it's not for us to say, oh, well, only 15% of the public are Euros, you know, want to leave the European Union, which was probably the figure in the noughties. You know, we have a duty, I think, to represent different bands of opinion. As for whether we gave him a good time, a hard time, I think we did give him a hard time. The trouble is that Farage was very good at arguing back and very good at making his case. And I think actually, if anybody's to blame for Brexit, it's not us broadcasters who promoted Farage. It's the failure of Remain politicians, senior Remain politicians, to put their necks on the line and argue for the virtues of EU membership.
Yeah.
There were only one, for all those years, it was only sort of Ken Clark and Michael Heseltine who were doing it. Most of them just cowered and were terrified that they would be crucified by right-wing newspapers. And that, I think, played a much bigger role broadcast producers and reporters giving Farage disproportionate coverage. I don't think it was disproportionate anyway.
And actually, to build on your point, Michael, I mean, the great and the good Professor Vernon Bogdanor at our sister institution, King's, has made the point that until the referendum, effectively, because of the way the British party system worked and the first past the post voting system works, if you did want to leave the European Union, which is an entirely legitimate worldview, you were faced with three political parties, certainly mainstream parties in England, and to some extent in Wales and Scotland, where they were all in favour of staying in the EU. So there was no outlet for your view.
Exactly.
So, I mean, you know, so I hear the point you make.
It was a legitimate debate to have. And maybe it's a debate that if we'd had it earlier, and had it more seriously, this debate about our membership to the European Union as broadcasters or as academics, it may not have ended up as it did. I mean, I personally am a Remainer. I regret that we left the European Union. But I do think that people who are Remainers mishandled it. And I also think that as a Democrat and a pluralist, we have a duty to represent, and a broadcaster, we have a duty to represent that point of view.
Absolutely. Now, Stephen Webb, read the relationship between Trump and Farage, which you've already mentioned. To what extent does Michael feel that Farage was genuinely on the inside track with Trump's agenda? And what are the prospects for future Trump-Farage relations? international relations question. Very good.
Well, Trump and Farage would regularly see each other during the Trump presidency. I mean, I say regularly, probably every 6 months. Farage would go to Washington, would stay in Trump's hotel near the White House. And Trump would often eat in his hotel rather than the White House because he didn't like the White House food, so they would see each other there. They would meet at CPAC conferences. And, you know, Trump was incredibly grateful to Farage because in the summer of 2016, you remember, Trump wasn't doing that well in the polls. And then he had the whole of that scandal involving Grab a Pussy, the clip that came out. And most Republicans were cowering. And here was this politician who was from England, and Americans always have a thing about Englishmen, who'd come across and who was, you know, he was the man who'd confounded all the polls and confounded all the experts and had won the Brexit referendum. And Trump was able to say, and that's exactly what I'm doing. And here was the man, Trump Farage, who came across representing the little man, which is exactly what I'm doing, Donald Trump. Now, Farage actually didn't jump on the Trump bandwagon until about halfway through 2016. I think, and he sort of indicated this, he had, serious doubts about Trump as we all did. And I think he still does. I mean, he doesn't, for instance, bang on about the election being stolen in the way that Trump still does. However, he's become a Trump groupie, really. He so loved the idea of being in the White House, being close to the president, you know, closer than Theresa May or our ordinary leaders were, that he was, you know, prepared to go along with aspects of Trumpism, the more extreme aspects of Trumpism. And he's now a champion for Trump getting re-elected. And of course, a huge critic of Joe Biden, which, of course, is not difficult if you are of Farage's politics anyway.
There's a question about, I'm going to slightly to summarise, about his, you said that you didn't think he was a racist, but what about conspiracies and antipathy to George Soros? Does he believe in conspiracies? I mean, in the sort of, figures on his part of the political spectrum sometimes are attributed to. Did your book reveal any of that?
Well, I think there was a period around sort of 2015, 16, 17, when Farage would spend a lot of time in America, and he always has spent a lot of time in America, and he would be appearing on talk radio shows with some of these more extreme people who would be going on, and of course Trump himself going on about how the bankers and these world conspiracies, and yeah. Farage would nod in that direction, yeah. And you know, some people argue that is anti-Semitic, and I think some of the people that Farage was consorting with and being was willing to do the radio shows are probably can legitimately be described as anti-Semitic. I don't think Farage himself is anti. He was a terrible, appalling anti-Semite at school, but I don't think he is now. He's very pro-Israel, but he mixed with the wrong people for a while in American politics. just in the same way that he mixed with the wrong people in European politics. And in the European Parliament, he had appalling alliances with, Lega Nord and people in the League of Polish Families, people who had track records of convictions for racist acts and acts of violence and anti-Semitism and anti-homosexual statements in the past. I mean, if you go through each of the groupings that Farage put together in the European Parliament, because if you put together a grouping, you get extra money, and Farage got extra status. He was the leader of the grouping. He sat on the front of the hemicycle, next to the president of the European Commission. And he was brilliant at putting those coalitions together.
It's a sort of cynical opportunism. Sorry, to put words in, a sort of cynical opportunism, indeed, allowing himself indeed. To be, yeah. In fact, yeah, that question and came from G. Leslie. Instance, yeah. So I'm just saying who the question came from, because I'd forgotten to say who had read the question. Sorry, you keep going, Michael, sorry.
Well, I think I've come to an end there. So
okay, now just G. Leslie was the questioner there, who I actually failed to mention. There's an excellent question about Ukraine that I'm going to hold for a second. And if you got 5 minutes, we started a bit late. If we run over 5 minutes, would that be all right for you, Michael?
Of course, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Go on as long as you want. Yeah.
Okay, very good. Andrew Lone asked a question. Please, could you say something about Farage and his view of Enoch Powell? Now, Enoch Powell, for those watching who don't remember, was a... you say more about this. Explain, deconstruct Enoch Powell and why this is such an interesting question.
Well, I mean, Enoch Powell was a hugely important conservative politician between about 1950 and 1975. And was in and out of conservative. Well, he was a member of the Macmillan government. He resigned over government spent as a Treasury minister, if I remember rightly, but came back as a health minister. And at a time when the health service was hugely dependent on foreign migrant labour, but then took up the issue of immigration in the late 60s with the famous Rivers of Blood speech. And Ted Heath sacked him from the shadow cabinet. And from then on, for the next 6 years, Powell really campaigned on the issue of both immigration and also was one of the great early Eurosceptics, always campaigned against our membership of the common market and especially in the 1975 referendum. And Powell actually went to Dulwich College as a guest speaker. I don't know the precise year, but during Farage's time there, and was a huge inspiration to Farage. And Farage always says that Powell was one of his heroes. Now, Powell is now regarded as a demonic figure, really, in our history, as a huge racist. And there were some things he said in his speeches which were very racist. I mean, Powell was a very, very clever man. An academic, a professor of Greek at the age of 24, if I remember rightly, at the University of Sydney or somewhere like that. He was a great hero to Farage, and Farage was so excited during the Newbury by-election. I was there in 1993 when Alan Sked, the gentleman, the LSE professor we've mentioned a couple of times, was the candidate for what was then the Anti-Federalist League, which became UKIP. And Sked persuaded Powell to come down to Newbury, and Farage drove him from London down to Newbury, and then they had dinner in the pub, and then Farage drove them, and then the meeting, and then drove them back again. Powell was an important influence, I think, on Farage, although they didn't meet that often. Some people, I think, sort of try and say, well, Powell was a racist, they argue, therefore Farage must be. And I don't think the logic really worked, because I don't really think Powell was a racist. I think he occasionally said things that construed as racist. But I think that, like Farage, Powell could be accused of pandering to racism. And certainly he did attract a lot of racist voters, including London Dockers, who marched in about 1968, I can't remember exactly, saying Powell is right, we need to get rid of all the blacks and so on. Important figure in Farage's life. Who else was important to? Well, Thatcher and Joseph. I mean, all those early conservative monetarist, Eurosceptic, free traders of the 1970s. I think if the Conservative Party, you know, if they were still around, Farage would probably still be a conservative.
I mean, I don't want to dwell on Enoch Powell, but I think Powell's in many ways on social policy other than immigration, relatively a liberal. I mean, he was quite a liberal politician other than where he ended up on that one issue. So everybody, you know, a little more nuanced than at first sight they appear.
Yeah.
Now, Rollo Masietto's, who's a current LSE student, says, thanks for an interesting talk so far. Many far right, and this, of course, brings us right up to date. And I was going to ask a question about this myself, Rollo, so well done. Thanks. Many far right Putin apologists are on the back foot after the horrific footage filtering in from Ukraine. And I was going to say, you know, he once described Putin as the world leader he most admires. Now, it's true, it was in 2014, but still, adding to Rollo's point, to what extent is Farage implicated in the unfolding dodgy Russian money scandal, as he puts it in inverted commas? But let's broaden it out. I mean, I was going to say, how far do you think this damages him, Farage, that is?
Well, I think it does damage him. And Farage has more than once made clear his admiration for Putin. He did it, most famously, I think, in an interview he did with Alistair Campbell for GQ magazine. I mean, just seeing the way in which Farage used to run UKIP and then the Brexit Party, you can see why he's an admirer of Putin. I mean, they're very similar in style. There's not much room for critics and opponents in the party. Anybody who causes any trouble, or anybody who looks like a potential, you know, leadership contender or is a threat, is that Farage was just absolutely brilliant and ruthless at purging them. I mean, probably the best example is Suzanne Evans, who I always thought was a good performer and was an obvious future leader of UKIP. But Farage, you know, concocted. I mean, again, Putin concocted, basically. Farage and his friends concocted some charges against her, which ended up with her being suspended for 6 months, which meant she couldn't stand for leader. I mean, in a way, you have to admire the way he operated. And he was, you know, he didn't have any time for his NEC. He basically believed, you know, the leader of UKIP or the leader of the Brexit Party should be the dictator. So you can see why he might admire Putin. On the Russian money front, well, we've got to be very careful here because there have been a lot of allegations made over the years. And they've all ended up really being unproven, and indeed there have been libel. I mean, it really revolves around Farage's former friend, Aaron Banks, who gave a lot of money to UKIP. There was all sorts of speculation as to where Banks got this money from. Banks is married to a Russian, and Banks was very close to the Russian embassy at one point and was regularly round seeing the ambassador. People put these facts together, and they suggested that Russia had been funding the Brexit campaign through Aaron Banks and so on. But it has never been established, even though Russia has in the past financed other parties in Europe. There is no evidence that they funded the Brexit campaign, even though Russia clearly they made it clear at the time that they approved of Brexit. I don't think there is a story there. I may one day be proved to be terribly wrong, but I've made that judgment. I don't think there is a story there. And I think most of the allegations have crumbled.
Okay, that's very clear. And let's move on. When I was sort of preparing for this evening, let me ask you the question rather than giving me my own night thoughts. I mean, can you think of any British historical figures, let's say in the 20th and 21st century, and you sort of made a point about the 21st century already, can you think of any British historical figures who are comparable to Farage in the senses? Individuals who are not exactly leading figures inside major political parties, prime ministers, chancellors, whatever, but who've significantly affected the country and its politics. So though Farage is a politician, I mean, the ones I came up with was, you know, Friedrich Hayek and Margaret Thatcher. Could be argued. I mean, if I'm right about that, or, you know, the Beveridge report, Beveridge and the Attlee government. But I was trying to think of an analogous figure in, the last 50 or 60 or 70 years, who's somebody who isn't quite, they're not themselves a frontline UK political politician, and yet they've managed to have so much effect and influence.
Well, I don't think...
Analysis is wrong, by the way. I mean,
I can't immediately think of it. I mean, if I'm talking about people who have been politicians who have been influential without holding any of the big jobs, I mean, I suppose you're talking about Joseph Chamberlain. Alex Salmond, I think we would also argue, was hugely influential and very nearly achieved independence way back in whenever it was, 2014. I don't think anybody sort of compares with Farage in that way. But I do think that what's interesting about our politics is how the spread of elections has given new opportunities for political careers. And traditionally, up until the start of my adult life, really, up until about 1980, Westminster was where it was all at. And now, with the European Parliament, that gave Farage a platform, and gave one or two other people platforms as well, but they then went to Westminster. But also you've got the Scottish Assembly, you've got the Welsh Assembly, and the Greater London Assembly, and you've got all the mayors. So you've now got all sorts more routes into politics, in the same way that in America, you can either be a governor, you can either be a governor and become president, or you can be a senator or a congressman and go to president that way. There are different career routes in British politics. Now, departure of our membership, our departure from the European Union, means that the European Parliament is no longer such a route. But of course, the government is committed to having more and more mayors, and that will become more of a route in future. This is a bit of a long way from Farage, but I do think we are seeing more politicians who are less traditional in what they've done. And what we saw in the teen years is a range of politicians: Salmond, George Galloway, Ken Livingstone, Boris Johnson, Nigel Farage, one or two others who were big players in our politics without really any of them being proper Westminster players.
I think you could argue, and I would argue, that the green lobby and green politics, though it doesn't get very far in conventional terms, has had a profound influence on all the major political parties. And that's a kind of a movement and an idea, environmentalism, rather than an individual. But I think it's not quite a parallel, but it's analogous, I think, in some ways.
And of course, you also had a period when trade union leaders were hugely powerful figures, but not politicians.
Jack Jones and Hugh Scanlon come to mind.
Sorry?
Jack Jones, Hugh Scanlon and others, yes. Now, one final question from the audience, and I think we probably will need to wrap up. From an observer of European politics, this is Sun Yang Cham, if I pronounce that correctly. Did Michael, send a draft of his biography to Farage for approval prior to publication? And if so, was there any reaction? I'm guessing
not. No, I certainly didn't. No. My political biographies, every biography I've done independently, apart from the one I did of David Butler. When I'm writing about a controversial character, they're independent. I don't do it with their cooperation. I tell them out of courtesy that I'm doing it. And my hope is that they, although I don't want to talk to them, because generally they've said so many things already, we've got their version of events already. I like to talk to everybody around them. That I can possibly find. And I did that pretty successfully with Farage. It was a bit limited because of COVID. He didn't really put great obstacles in my way of me talking to people, which is, good. And actually that's shows the sort of liberal side of Farage. And frankly, if anybody was writing a book about me, not that they ever will, I want all my friends to talk, because you can be sure your enemies will. No, I would. You can't submit your. I mean, unless you're. I mean, there are some biographies that, you know, are written with masses of cooperation with the subject, and they are submitted to the subject. But if I'd submitted my manuscript to Farage, we'd still be arguing about it, yeah. And the lawyers would have got involved, and it might never have achieved publication.
I mean, I can see this is a good question from an academic, because you know we're always talking about making sure if you're doing, you know, interviews and qualitative research, you get your, if you want to quote people, you get their agreement and all of that. So it's a slightly different approach to the one you've adopted. Now, I can remember myself using, this is, you know, was involved in writing a book some year, actually with the earlier mentioned David Butler many years ago, where we sent some of the choice quotes about the policy disaster concerned to the people we'd interviewed, or in some cases not interviewed in this particular case, just to see, to check it. And we gave them a sort of, if you don't write back, we'll assume you agree, kind of. So they either had to agree to the quote or then write back, but that's a slightly passive aggressive way of not doing the right. It's a respectable technique, I think.
I mean, with other people, I mean, a lot of the people I interviewed and my researchers interviewed said, well, look, if you're going to quote me in the book by name, yeah, can you check the quote?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I did. And that process, yeah, that sometimes you think, oh, they're going to, you know, withdraw it or they're going to water it down. And occasionally try and do that. But more often they say, oh,
they sharpen it up.
There's a lot more, or it was even worse than that, you know, and they beef it up. Yeah. So it's actually, yes. it can be quite a positive process.
Final question, and this will have to be the final question. Did you come away from writing the book liking or disliking the subject, your subject?
Well, I dislike that. I mean, when I meet Farage, and I haven't met him since the book came out, but I've got to say, he's good company. He's good fun. He's good to have a drink with, go to lunch with. But I'm not an admirer of most of his politics. Occasionally he'll say things that I will agree with or think he has a good point. And I'm certainly not an admirer of his. Well, I'm not a fan of his methods in terms of the ruthless way he used to run UKIP and purge people and get rid of his enemies and all sorts of terrible things went on there. I think that's a dreadful way of operating, but I can see why he did it. So I'm not an admirer of him in that respect. But you know, his ability to communicate, his ability to understand public opinion, his ability to, the stamina, the sheer stamina of the guy, the amount of work he was putting in, non-stop. And he wasn't, you know, there were not that many good people around him to help him, partly because he got rid of them. He did have a huge burden in running UKIP all of those years and then kept coming back and so on. So you've got to sort of admire the persistence and energy of the man. So it is, I'm afraid, a mixed picture. I can't give you a yes or no answer to that, but I do think I've explained really where it stands. And I think I learned he was during the process of doing research in the book, I realized just how ruthless he could be in the way he operated.
Something of a reversal here, really, isn't it? Because journalists are the ones who normally want absolutely categorical yes no binary answers, and I'm now asking you exactly that. And you know, fair enough, you've given a nice academic nuanced response, so that's excellent. Well, look, it's now 8 minutes past six. We've slightly overrun our time. All it really remains for me to do is to thank Michael Crick. I should encourage everybody who's watched to buy a copy of the book. I think I'm allowed to do that.
Please.
Why not? In all good bookshops, it'll be something to read over the Easter holidays and beyond. So seriously, and you've made the point indirectly yourself, but I think it's easy for me to make this point, given how important Nigel Farage has been for British politics, whether you like him or don't like him, whether you think Brexit's a good idea or not a good idea, it is inconceivable that history will not want to see a balanced, objective attempt, you know, as far as we can ever get, at an analysis of his rise into politics. So I'd like to thank you, Michael, both for coming along this evening and answering all these questions in such an engaged way, but also obviously for adding just that little bit of extra to British history for us all. So with that in mind, I look forward to seeing you again soon, and and others in the audience, I hope. But that's it really from the LSE this evening. So have a very good evening. And
thank you.